Dr. Robert C. Newman, Professor of New Testament at Biblical Theological Seminary.
Our discussion this morning is interpreting the parables, and I've structured the talk with two basic headings. The first heading I'll call Principles with Problems. Some principles that are commonly used in connection with parable interpretation that have some merit to them perhaps, but have some very serious problems. And then my second heading will be some principles with merit, or some less well-known principles with more merit. So they're not beyond any argumentation either. But the first thing we want to look at rather briefly, some common interpretive principles with problems. A very common interpretive principle we often see for parables is an explanation of what they are. And that is a statement, a parable is an earthly story with a heavenly meaning. Or, plural, parables are earthly stories with heavenly meanings. Now, that principle certainly explains a large quantity of parables that exist. A story about normal, everyday type of events, but which has a meaning beyond the literal. It's an illustration or something of that variety, and that other story, that the meaning behind it is in fact some sort of a spiritual principle, some sort of a heavenly meaning, as we say. Now, the trouble with that is that there are a whole class of parables that don't fall in a category. The one that people most commonly run into that does not fall into that category is the parable Lazarus and the Rich Man. Lazarus and the Rich Man, located in Luke 16, verses 19 through 31, is a story about what happens to two people after they die. It's not an earthly story. And it is not intended to be interpreted in some figurative sense. It is an example of what happens to these two people, who may or may not be real people. That does not make a great deal of difference in a particular story. It's what happened to two particular people after they died, and the situation involved there. Now, many have dealt with this particular problem by saying Lazarus and the Rich Man isn't a parable. No. So earthly stories with heavenly meaning still works, but Lazarus and the Rich Man is not a parable. I've heard many people react to the Seventh-day Adventist attempt to get around this particular story, Lazarus and the Rich Man. They say, when you die, you do not exist. You're sleeping or something of that variety until the resurrection, and therefore you say, well, what about Lazarus and the Rich Man? And they say, it's a parable. And then they give you some kind of spiritual meaning that it has. And you may be tempted to respond, no, it's not a parable. But the trouble with that is that there are several more parables of the same sort that are called parables that fall in the same category. Another good example of the same sort of thing would be the Pharisee and the publican, found in Luke 18, verses 9 through 14. Here we have an earthly story, all right. But the meaning is not some arcane meaning. The Pharisee is an example of a person who is self-righteous. The publican is an example of a person who has been wicked, but who has come to recognize his wickedness and cast himself upon God's mercy and repent. They're examples. They're not something with a heavenly meaning. They are, in fact, examples of exactly what they're telling you about. So they are earthly story with an earthly meaning, or they're an example of something going on. And that particular parable is explicitly called a parable. In verse 9, Luke 18:9. The rich fool would be another parable that falls in this category, found in Luke 12, verses 16 through 21. The rich fool is admittedly more of an earthly story than Lazarus and the Rich Man, since Lazarus and the Rich Man, most of it takes place after they're dead. Okay, remember, though, even with Lazarus and the Rich Man, the first part of it takes place while they're still alive on earth, so the earthly story starts out there, it just switches realms. So does the rich fool. The rich fool starts out, the guy's got all these barns, and they're getting full, and what's he going to do with his money and his crops, and he tears them down and builds bigger ones, eat, drink, be merry, etc. And then God says, you fool, this night your soul will be required of you. Whose then will it be? Is that some story with some separate level of meaning? No, it isn't. But is it a parable? Yes, verse 16 calls it a parable. So, rich fool, Luke 12, 16 through 21 is called a parable, verse 16. And therefore, we've got to admit it to that category. The Good Samaritan, likewise, falls in the same kind of category. Earthly story of some sort, but apparently does not have a heavenly meaning separate on some level, some different level of operation. There we have an example of how people ought to react. Who is their neighbor? Anyone they come in contact with who is in need. What should they do? Well, the fellow does for the fellow what he needs and helps him out. Go and do likewise. It is true that some Christians have taken the Good Samaritan as a parable of an earthly story with a heavenly meaning. An earthly story about a fellow going down from Jerusalem to Jericho is in fact Adam going from the heavenly city Jerusalem down to the city of change, Jericho. Jericho is a play on the word moon, and the moon changes through the months, so he's going down. He falls among thieves. Satan and his henchmen rob him of his righteousness. The Levite and the priest represent liturgical righteousness and works righteousness and sort of thing, and they just pass by. They can't do anything. The Good Samaritan is Jesus. He helps him. The oil and the wine represent the sacraments. The hostelry he takes him to represents the church, things of that variety. But in fact, that's rather heavily violating what Jesus himself does with the parable. Rather, I think most of us would understand that the parable of the Good Samaritan is in fact an illustration of how we ought to react in various circumstances. We ought not to consider our neighbor merely the fellow that lives next door, but whomever we come in contact with who has a need that we ought therefore to supply. So my suggestion here is that the principle, an earthly story with heavenly meaning, does have problems. It leaves out a rather substantial class of parables. Now, another principle which you will see occasionally, though it has some serious problems, is the idea that parables are intended to clarify the truth, not to hide it. Parables are intended to clarify the truth, not to hide it. This is a common liberal view of the matter. You look in Ulliker, Dodd, many of these other, Jeremias, many of these other men, they will say, parables are not intended to hide the truth at all. They're intended to clarify it. Anywhere we find a parable in Scripture where it seems it has an arcane meaning given to it or something that one would hardly guess hearing it, that is evidence that editors have been at work on the material. And to get back to the real parable as Jesus gave it, you strip off all its interpretation and throw it away and take the parable by itself, guess what its context might have been, and figure out what sort of meaning it ought to have had. You can see as I presented that there that it is a liberal treatment by and large. And so those who would treat the Bible as a revelation from God are not likely to go after this particular type of material. This interpretation that the purpose of parables is to clarify truth, is only to clarify truth, is in fact one which must reject Jesus' own statements about the matter in Matthew 13, Mark 4, Luke 8, where he speaks of blessed are you because you understand these things, and to you is given the interpretation, to you is given to know the mysteries of the kingdom of heaven, but to those outside it is not given. I was asked by someone before I started this talk if I was going to explain all the ins and outs of that, and the answer is no, I'm not, because I've got a lot of material. I'll have trouble getting through an hour and a half anyway, but let me say a word or two about that particular matter. The parables have a number of uses, as we'll come to see. And one class of parables fall in the area of what we might call riddle-type parables. They are intended to obscure things from those who aren't really serious about the matter. And I believe Jesus, at this point in his ministry, in Matthew 13 and following, begins to use, in some occasions, particularly at that occasion, begins to use parables that if a person is only looking out for trying to shoot down Jesus or something, he's going to have a tough time because he's going to have to work to try and find out what Jesus is saying about the material. But that is something that occurs only after Jesus has been well into his ministry, has given very good evidence that he is from God, and the people have gone, the leaders especially, have gone to extreme lengths to try and explain away what Jesus is doing. That they finally have to come down to it's Satan that's doing these things rather than God. And by the time you've been able to manipulate the data that much, then Jesus basically turns and begins to use parables in a way that those who are really interested in him and really think there may be something to what he's saying, they're willing to go to the work of finding out what the meaning of these parables are. Those who aren't, it will not make enough sense to them that they'll be able to attack them easily or anything of that variety. Off our subject. We might, however, consider a third interpretive principle that might be fairly common, and that is using Matthew 13 as the explanation of what parables are for and saying parables are intended to hide the truth rather than to clarify it. I don't know that anyone really would push such a extreme version of interpretive principle, but it's sort of an overreaction to the liberal view. Some conservatives might say, well, Ulliker and Dodd and Jeremias and these men have ignored Matthew 13's statement and therefore go to the other side and say the real purpose of parables is to hide things. Now, the trouble with that theory is that as you look through the Gospels, you find that there's something like a dozen parables or more that occur before Matthew 13. That is, Jesus was already using parables before Matthew 13. And many of the parables, it's rather clear what they're about. They're not obscure. They're something that is intended to picture vividly what's going on, that sort of thing. Even John the Baptist, for instance, with the idea that the axe is laid at the root of the trees. It's like somebody about to cut down the tree, and rather obviously in his context, he's talking about what God is about to do to Israel. And if you don't get with it, if you don't repent, then this disaster will come upon you. Well, Jesus, too, uses a number of parables before that time. I don't have my list with me here if I'm all in order, but I believe the parable of the wineskins occurs before this time, a number of others. In evangelical circles, then I think we should understand that neither are parables strictly to disguise the truth, nor are they strictly to clarify the truth. Both of those things can be used under different circumstances, and therefore both of these principles by themselves have some problems. You have to try and find out which is being involved, and basically you find that out by trying to figure out what it says, seeing what Jesus has to say about it in the context, things of that variety. We want to run on quickly to two other, rather related, that is related to each other, principles with problems. Fourth principle then, parables make only one basic point. Parables make only one basic point. This is very common among liberals. Again, we're talking about Ulliker, Dodd, Jeremias, and others of that stripe. The idea that the more complicated New Testament parables are actually parables that have been jazzed up in the course of their transmission. Either two parables have been welded together or a complicated meaning have been given, something of that sort. So, for instance, a parable like the prodigal son, which you have basic point of the son returning, but a secondary point of the older son being rather grouchy about the whole matter and the father having to argue with him, etc. There's a more complicated structure to that parable. And they would say, but that's not the original form of the parable. Throw out the elder son and work with the other. That's the parable. And then the elder son may be another parable. Or the wedding feast for the king's son, where you have the king sending out people to invite people to the wedding and they won't come and he gets mad at them and destroys their city. That would be perhaps the original parable jazzed up a little bit in the liberal view. Perhaps you would see Luke's thing where a homeowner sends out invitations to a wedding and is mad because nobody will come and invites other people. And that would be the original. It's been jazzed up to make it a king with armies, etc. But then this whole thing about the wedding garment at the end, this is another parable that's been welded on. Things of that variety. So basically, this liberal variety of this thing is that the more complicated New Testament parables are not original. They've been jazzed up some way. And the parables which have rather complicated interpretations, like the sower, where you've got four different kinds of ground, and each different thing that's going on has specific significance. Liberals will say, the interpretation's all been added. Sweep away the interpretation. Go back and figure out what's going on. So in that form, this particular principle is rather common among liberals. You can see it takes very little cognizance of the Bible's own statements about the things and very little regard for the historicity of the material. However, you will also find this kind of a principle used among evangelicals in saying, they get a little irked because some rather zealous evangelicals have found 95 different things going on in the parable, and they say, good night. Parables only make one basic point. What are you doing trying to find out the meaning of all of these things? You know, why it's three measures a meal and how big a measure is and what the significance of that is and whether hiding is significant and things of that sort. And whether it's a woman, you know, why is the woman, is it a woman significant? Things of that variety. And so they say, well, take it easy. Just don't overinterpret the thing. Just one basic point. Well, I think we have to ask ourselves, what does one basic point mean? A telephone book has only one basic point. Convey telephone numbers to people. It certainly got a lot of subpoints. A unified sermon has only got one basic point. Well, if it's a classic sort, it will have an introduction and three or four points and a conclusion and things of that variety. You know, there's a lot of structure to it, even though it may have only one basic point. So there's some problems with a principle of that variety, and you have to at least ask yourself, how do you find out that a parable's only got one basic point? Well, one way to find out is interpret them all and find out if they've only got one basic point, but that's the whole point at issue, so it's a little quick to rush into that. A rather related matter, which I think has got a little bit more merit to it, is the fifth principle here, don't make a parable walk on all fours. What's that all about? Well, obviously it's a metaphor of some variety. It's the idea of people walk on 2 feet, and if you try to make them walk on their hands as well, it's rather ludicrous. Well, parables are designed to walk on 2 feet or something. If you make them walk on all four, that's rather ludicrous. I think this is a much more common way of stating number four in evangelical circles, and it's, I think, much less objectionable than the other. As it is metaphorical, we should note that the metaphor is only good if parables only have 2 feet. If parables have 4 feet, then they ought to walk on all four of them. So you bring yourself back to the question, how do you know how much structure a parable has that has significance to it? And that's not easy to answer, but we're going to try and work in that general direction here a little bit. So here are five principles, probably could find some more, that are pretty common in discussing parables, and all of them have certain problems. And I think we can suggest some principles that have less problems anyway, although they're not going to solve everything for us. You realize hermeneutical principles don't solve all your problems. First place, people disagree on hermeneutical principles. And the second place, the hermeneutical principles presumably have to be derived inductively anyway, which means you have to do the interpretation and find out what you get. So they're sort of a helpful guide to getting into understanding the Bible and keeping you from going off into odd directions, but they do not themselves solve everything for you. Our second line of discussion, in which we'll spend much more time on, is what I have called briefly on the overhead, because there's not so much room to write, but on my outline here, less well-known principles with more merit. Less well-known principles with more merit. These have got some merit up here, but they've got some problems. These, I think, have got some more merit and some less problems. The first one I don't think has many problems at all, and that is this. The New Testament word parable refers to a broad class of figures. The New Testament word parable refers to a broad class of figures of speech. Okay, refers to a broad class of figures. Now, in English literature, in English hermeneutics, etc., the word parable has a rather specific meaning. In English, the word parable means a story that is designed to convey some other sort of truth. And we usually think of a parable as an extended simile. A simile, remember, is kind of a one-word or two-word comparison. When you say, it is like a furnace in here. That's a little exaggerated. It's not that hot in here. But you're saying the temperature in here can be compared to that in a furnace, okay? So that would be a simile, just one comparison, and it's sort of just one idea compared to one idea. A parable also uses the idea like in English, talking about now English terminology, also uses the word like or as, but a whole story over here is comparable to a somewhat more complicated situation over here to make a point. That's what we normally mean by the word parable in English. The Greek word parabole is broader than that. I'd like to show you some examples of that from the New Testament, which on all but one of these, the actual word parable is used. So it's therefore a reasonable word study. But here, just giving you classes that I've already divided up. I didn't invent all this myself. For various types of things that go under the name parable in New Testament usage. Some of this background comes from Greek background, and some of this background comes from Old Testament background, where the word parable is a translation for the Hebrew mashal, which we translate more commonly proverb, perhaps. The first of these categories, I've got 8 categories here in the New Testament use of the word parable, is what is called in English usually the similitude. Matthew 4:30 is the verse that contains the word parable that is located in a similitude. Find Matthew 4:30 here. Take a quick look at that one. Oh, off to a great start. Mark 4:30. Sorry. I have the right in my notes, but I got the wrong one on the overhead. How shall we picture the kingdom of God, or by what parable shall we present it? It is like a mustard seed, which, when grown upon the soil, though it is smaller than all the seeds that are upon the soil, yet when it is grown, it grows up and becomes larger than all the garden plants and forms large branches, so that the birds of the air can nest under its shade. How do we define a similitude? A similitude is not exactly a story. It's more of a common occurrence, an everyday occurrence, rather than a particular incident. A common occurrence which parallels a lesson, which has a lesson as its that makes it a parable, okay? So instead of being some unique story of some variety that's only happened once, it is a common everyday occurrence, and over here then it has some significance. I've given you one here where the actual word parable occurs, Mark 4:30, the parable of the mustard seed. Another example would be the woman. A woman took 3 measures of meal. That's a normal amount of meal that would be taken for a day or so supply of bread. Women are the ones who normally make bread in the home. She puts leaven in it, which is a normal thing done, and the leaven expands the bread, which is what it normally does. Okay, so the event, the incident, the occurrence, which is to teach a lesson, is an everyday occurrence, and you're not talking about something unusual or something that occurs only once or something that mentions a particular person by name or something. That would be what we call a similitude. A second use of the New Testament word parable is what I call parable proper or parable story. This is, in fact, what we mean by parable in the English usage of the word in literature and such. And here, Matthew 21:33 would be an example, I think. You can argue sometimes about what are good examples for these. A landowner makes himself a vineyard with all its accoutrements, and he hires it out to tenant farmers. And the tenant farmers begin to work it, but then when the harvest comes that they ought to be paying a part of the produce to the owner, they refuse to do it, and they keep they send away his slaves sent to get the produce, and then they begin to injure them, etc. Finally, he sends his son, and they kill him, etc. Here we have obviously a rather specific incident. Not something that's just an everyday occurrence. It's a tenant farmer that won't pay. That might not be that rare, okay? But instead of the usual thing happening where the tenant, where the owner comes with a judge and a small contingent of the army and boots the guys out of there, he keeps sending slaves, very unusual, after a couple have gotten killed, and then finally he sends his son, which is even more unusual, and this sort of thing. So it would be something very much like a unique incident. And this then has a interpretation for it. That would then be a second one, and the difference between a similitude and a parable proper would basically be a common occurrence versus a specific story. Both of those would, however, tend to lean in the direction of one basic point, and both of them I think we could call in some sense a earthly story with a heavenly meaning. Okay, so they both do satisfy two of the principles we said do have problems. These particular ones happen to satisfy that. Yes? Could be either way. Could be either way. I'll show you. I've actually got a heading here of things that tend to obscure things, but that feature can be applied to other varieties. Okay? So, yeah. But many of these would be rather obvious what's going on, since they're making basically a point, and the context will tell you something about what that point is. The third category is what is often called allegory. Now, this is not exactly like what we mean by allegory in English, but an allegory also is a specific story like the parable proper, often a more complex story, even at times slightly artificial story. Something very unusual happens which you wouldn't expect in the story, but I don't know how much you want to press that. The real point that differs between an allegory and a parable proper is that in the parable proper, there's kind of the one basic point, and so if you once can figure out what that point is, you can see how everything fits together in the story to back that up. The allegory will have several independently significant features in it, which you would have to have some information on what they represent. And if you don't have information on what they represent, you may be at a loss to know what's going on. The parable of the sower is a good example of an allegory-type parable. you don't automatically know that the birds that snatch off the grain are Satan, etc. You don't automatically know that the rock, I'm not sure we know what the rock represents, but that the sun represents persecution. You don't automatically know that the weeds and such represent the cares of the world. You don't even automatically know that the sower is the gospel going forth and that the ground represents the person and the seed represents the word, etc. You have to be told those things. And being told one or two of them does not allow you to work out the whole thing. You actually have to know a very high fraction of the correspondences to be able to figure out what's going on. And so you can see how this can very well be a rather obscure sort of thing, much more likely to be obscure sort of thing. This category of allegory goes against, then, a number of these principles we've looked at. The one of the idea of clarifying truth not to obscure it, the idea of making one basic point, or even the problem of making parables walk on all fours. They've got to walk on whatever they've got. And however you find out what they've got, basically, for this kind of thing is going to have to be knowing some interpretation or having some hints to the interpretation given somewhere. A fourth category is the acted parable. Here, you have the idea of a story with a meaning, that is a symbolic story with a meaning, but the story is acted out by the person who is giving the thing. Rather than he just says it or writes it, he acts it out. The two occurrences of parabole in the New Testament with this sort of thing occur in Hebrews 9:9 and Hebrews 11:19, where they refer to the activities of the high priest and his liturgical functions, and telling us essentially that the liturgical functions of the high priest are parabolic. They're symbolic actions. And we have some hints at their significance. The other place is the events relating to Isaac being told to sacrifice his son, Abraham being told to sacrifice his son Isaac, and then being stopped at the last minute by God, where the writer of Hebrews tells us that that action was a symbolic action again, and some hints then that he actually received his son back from the dead parabolically. In other words, delivering him from a sentence of death, and a hint perhaps that there's a symbolism of Abraham representing God and Isaac representing Jesus, though that's not brought out in detail in the passage. Among Jesus' activities, there is, I think, at least one which is pretty clearly an acted parable. That would be the cursing of the fig tree. There might be some others, though not perhaps so obvious, what we would call acted parables. I think personally as well that both baptism and the Lord's Supper are acted parables, but they fall in the category, like what the high priest does, liturgical actions that as we act them out, we convey a significance, remind ourselves of a significance, picture for ourselves the significance of things that are being done in the spiritual realm. Well, one more. The fifth type of parable here, type of thing that is used, that is called parable in the New Testament, is the paradigm. This could also be called an illustrative story or something else. Paradigm is one of the names that's used for it. Luke 12:16, the story of the rich fool. Now, the paradigm is what I had in mind in arguing against the first principle that we looked at in the previous section. Parables are earthly stories with heavenly meanings. Paradigms, which would include the rich fool, the Pharisee and the publican, Lazarus and the rich man, the good Samaritan, and possibly one or two others, are stories which illustrate how you ought to act or what is really going on, not transferring from some earthly realm to some heavenly realm, but giving you a sample of what's going on. The Good Samaritan is a sample of how we ought to react when we find someone in need. The Pharisee and the publican is a sample of a proper way of approaching God and a bad way of approaching God. The parable of the rich fool is a sample of the stupidity of materialism and thinking that you're going to get security in riches. The parable of the Lazarus and the rich man is a sample of what happens to the righteous and the wicked after death. Okay, so they're samples. There's not a transference of meaning like Lazarus represents righteousness and his poverty represents that righteous people ought to be poverty-stricken in this world, and poverty is wicked and riches are wicked, etc. But rather, this is a mistreatment of a poor fellow by a rich fellow, a rich fellow who is not using his goods the way he ought to, and when we see what happens to them, we ought to take a lesson from that. And so rather than switching from an earthly realm to a heavenly realm, they're stories about spiritual realities, but dealing with things right here on earth, or you actually see the transfer going on. That's what we would call a paradigm. Now, I have three other cases here. The proverb. A proverb is usually a concise saying of some variety. Often it is in common use, like a stitch in time saves nine, look before you leap, etc., that variety. One time in the New Testament, the term parabole is applied to proverb, though in fact that's a rather common translation in the Old Testament for the word mashal, which is often a proverb. The one example here, physician, heal yourself. Jesus says, you'll quote to me this proverb, physician, heal yourself. In other words, just as a physician ought to be able, if his works are any good, ought to be able to heal himself, so you, Jesus, if you're really a prophet, you ought to be able to do your miraculous activities at home as well as out there away from Nazareth. That would be what we would call a proverb. Number seven would be a paradox. Paradox. A paradox is a seemingly contradictory statement that is nevertheless true, and by thinking through the apparent contradiction, you come to a deeper understanding of some matter than you would otherwise. We were looking at a paradox just yesterday, I suppose, the day before, when we were discussing, as Dr. McCrae was discussing, answer not a fool according to his folly, lest you become like him. Answer a fool according to his folly, lest he be wise in his own eyes. It shows we have a problem when we're dealing with fools. Shall you argue with them and wind up using their methodology and getting their outlook and wind up being a fool yourself? Or shall you remain silent and the guy thinks his arguments are unanswerable? And the answer is you have to work between those two somehow. Paradoxes often work in that direction. The paradox here in Mark 7:17 is the idea of it is not what a person eats that defiles him. It is not what comes from outside that comes in that defiles him. It's what comes from inside and goes out that defiles him, which would seem more paradoxical to them with the whole idea of unclean foods. It's not unclean foods that make you unclean. It's an unclean person that produces what is unclean, something of that sort. It would be a paradoxical idea. I list this one because here the word parable is used with it. A very common paradox Jesus uses several times, however, is the first shall be last and the last shall be first. And that can be called a parabole in Greek, in the New Testament usage, although in fact the word does not happen to occur with it. Lastly, riddles. Riddles per se, that is intentionally obscure statements. I don't know of any good examples that occur with the name parabole in the New Testament. Some of the parables proper and some of the allegories have riddling features to them, things that are tough to understand. But there are examples given in Scripture in the New Testament would fall in the category of riddle, that is, sneaking by a person's defenses so that he doesn't know what's going on. I'll come back and say more about them later. But basically, that's the idea. It is true that parabole, when the Old Testament was translated into Greek, was rather regularly used for things that we would call riddles. So we have that background in New Testament times. Giving you this list, then, of New Testament use of parable shows you that it's going to be fairly tough to give you a set of principles that are going to apply to all of these things rather obviously. We will basically limit our discussion here, here on, to the material basically in 1 through 5. Notice not all of those fall in the category of earthly stories with heavenly meanings, although all of these, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, have some sort of a story structure to them. The one class, the paradigm, does not transfer to another level. It's just a sample of how you ought to act or a sample of how you ought not to act. The others, 1, 2, 3, 4, all do fall in the category of an earthly story with heavenly meaning. We'll not deal much with riddle, paradox, or proverb because they're only rarely called parabole in the New Testament. And obviously you do need some hermeneutical principles to recognize riddles and interpret them and to recognize paradoxes and interpret them, recognize proverbs and interpret them. But it would just get us into too long a discussion to deal with those matters. I want to turn next to the second of the principles that I think have some more merit, and one that deals particularly with the whole area of the riddle or the allegory something that is not obviously clear what's going on and how it has a very important use. As Will Varner was mentioning, the problem of God deceiving if things are not as clear as they might be, we don't want to press that too far because God may occasionally have a purpose for hiding what he's doing from someone until it takes its full force. You know, to be an honest, upright person and to be a general in an army does not require that you send a dispatch to your enemy telling him which way you're going to move, how you're going to divide your troops, and things of that variety. You don't owe him that information, so you can be slightly deceptive by sending a feint over in one direction, and he draws his forces over there, and then you send your other army in the other direction, or sneak up on them, okay? So God has the right to sneak up on people if what he is doing will be for their good if they repent. He has no obligation to do good to those who won't repent, to those who deserve nothing but his judgment. He has to be just when he judges, of course. Let's have a look at this second principle. The second principle, worded more fully, is this. Some parables are designed to sneak by the listener's defenses. Some parables are designed to sneak by the listener's defenses. There are some excellent Old Testament examples of this particular thing. Let me quickly give you them. There are three of them. They occur in 2 Samuel and 1 Kings. I'll just give one in detail. 2 Samuel 12, verses 1 through 4. David has committed adultery with Bathsheba, has had Uriah killed, etc. And God is going to confront him with that problem. God sneaks up on him. Nathan, the prophet, comes wandering into the throne room one day, and he has a problem. And David thinks he's telling about an actual situation going on in the kingdom and asking for the king's judgment. He says there was a rich fellow who had a huge flock, and a poor fellow who had only one little ewe lamb, and that lamb was a pet for the whole family. And some distant relative or someone came to visit the rich fellow, and the rich fellow needed to have a lamb for dinner, banquet, and rather than using one of his, he sends over somebody and grabs the poor fellow's lamb and has that one. And David becomes quite angry and says, the fellow ought to be killed, emotional reaction, but all I can do is what the law requires, be repaid multiple, I forgot whether it was 4 or 5 times he's to be repaid, etc. And that really doesn't replace the pet lamb, obviously, because the new ones aren't necessarily going to be pets until you've made them pets, etc. And then Nathan says, you are the man. He points right at him. And then it becomes rather clear as Nathan gives the interpretation of the parable that indeed David has reacted violently against, both emotionally in regard to justice, is in fact the very thing he had been doing himself. Two other good examples I'll let you look at sometime. 2 Samuel 14, verses 5 through 7. The widow's surviving son. A trick that is used by Joab to get Absalom back to the king's court. Rather interesting one, presented as a real story, though it did not actually happen. You say, well, she was a not too hot person and Joab wasn't too hot. So it's only scoundrels that invent stories for the purpose of making parables. But notice Nathan is okay, and he invented a story for the purpose of making a parable too. And then a third example, the parable of the escaped prisoner in 1 Kings 20, verses 39 through 40. Ahab has let the king of Syria get away from him, though God has told him to destroy the king of Syria. And so one of the prophets gets another person to mash him a few times so he looks beaten up and puts on a bandage over his face with the blood coming down and goes up to the king with the story. I was charged by one of the officers to guard this fellow with my life. And as I was working around doing these things, the guy got away, and what should happen? And the king says, you ought to be put to death. You've condemned yourself out of your own mouth. And before the guy with the sword can get up to wipe him out, he whips the bandage off his face, and Ahab suddenly sees that things are going wrong. It's a prophet, and the prophet is about to apply the lesson to himself and goes away very irked about the whole thing. In all three of these cases, the parable has been used to get the person to judge something rightly, as people normally will if it doesn't apply too closely to them, and then suddenly find out it applies to them. Some New Testament examples. The one had listed there under riddle would be an example. Luke 7, verses 40 through 43, especially verses 40 and 44. Take a quick look at that. This is the situation where Jesus has been invited to the home of a Pharisee, having a banquet. The Pharisee is obviously on the fence about Jesus. He wants to get to know more about him. He invites him, etc. But he's overlooked very signs of real hospitality. He hasn't kissed him. He hasn't anointed him. He hasn't washed his feet, etc. The Pharisees obviously trying to kind of stay on the fence until they find out who Jesus is like. This woman comes in to the feast, whom the Pharisee knows to be a notable sinner, presumably a prostitute or at least an unfaithful wife. And she begins to weep over Jesus and anoints his, and her tears fall on Jesus' feet, and then she cleans them with her hair and pours oil, perfume on it, all of that. And the Pharisee says, aha, I have my evidence. Jesus is a charlatan. If he were a prophet, he would know what kind of person this was. And if he's righteous, he wouldn't have anything to do with this kind of person. Well, Jesus is a prophet and knows what kind of person it is. And his having to do with her has to do with forgiveness and all of that. So Jesus says, without looking at the woman or anything of that sort, he says, Simon, I've got something to tell you. And he tells a story about two people who've been forgiven debts and asks Simon which of the two will love the guy to whom they owed the money more. And Simon says, well, I guess the person who's been forgiven the bigger debt. And then Jesus sneaks in and applies it. You see, the woman has been forgiven the bigger debt, and therefore she manifests that by showing more love. Interesting thing. We can't proceed on it further, but that's a good example of sneaking up on the person. The lost sheep example is another one, perhaps not so obvious, in Luke 15, verses 4 through 7. The Pharisees are complaining that Jesus is rejoicing and having a good time with people who are sinners, etc. And Jesus says to them, in the wrong chapter here, Jesus says several things to them, but in one of the things he says, Luke 15:4, what man of you, he says, if he has 100 sheep and loses one of them, doesn't go look for it? You don't just sit around and say, well, I got the 99 sheep, no big loss. You go try to recover your loss, okay? And he says, if you'll do that naturally, and so he works through the whole story in that direction, and naturally they would, then he comes back and makes the point on them. Isn't it natural for God to recover what belongs to him that is lost? If you're going to look at it from God's perspective, isn't it right for God to be concerned to go out and seek those that are lost? And another New Testament example would be the parable of the tenant farmers in Matthew 21, verses 33 through 43. Matthew 21, 33 through 43. We've already said a word about this parable, but in verse 40, therefore, when the owner of the vineyard comes, what will he do to these vine growers? He gets them to commit themselves. What will someone do? If he's built himself a vineyard, loaned it out to tenants, it belongs to him. They're only having the right to use it, which gives them some of the fruits. Some belong to him. What's he going to do when they have not only refused to pay, they have injured his servants and they've killed his son? And they answer it, he will bring those wretches to a wretched end and rent out the vineyard to to people who will pay him the proceeds at the proper season. Aha! And then he applies it, you see. Well, what is he going to do to Israel that have killed the prophets and are about to kill the son? He's going to kick them out of there and bring in somebody else, etc. So, same sort of idea. So verses 40 and 41 and 43 are the passages where he first gets them to commit themselves on the principle, and then he comes in and shows them what principle they committed themselves to. We find from the parallel accounts that some of the people had seen through it already and would not respond with the answer to the matter. But some of them hadn't seen it already and they responded. So, well, that's principle two. Principle one, parables are a broad class of figures. And they're a broad enough class that these things do not apply to all cases by any means. Some of them are designed to sneak by the defenses. Therefore, they're not all designed to clarify the truth. Though once you understand what's going on, you have in fact learned a principle that's valuable, but instead to get anything out of you. A third feature of parables is their use of stock symbolism. And this is the way I have this worded in my notes. Parables regularly employ stock symbolism from the Old Testament. This is most easily seen by comparing the parables of the New Testament with the rabbinic parables and noticing how they resemble each other, and then seeing that these stock symbols that they often have go back to Old Testament backgrounds. So that's why I got you to have these four pages. Parables, we're not going to have time to go over these in detail, but if you've got them all numbered, as I suggested, 1 through 5 on the page that says Biblical School of Theology, some rabbinic parables, 6 through 9 on some rabbinical parables continued, 10 through 16 on more rabbinic parables, Biblical Theological Seminary, the parables of Jesus, etc., and the last one, 17 through 23, on the fourth page labeled More Parables, then if you just take down these numbers, you can go look up some of these things yourself. When you begin to look at the rabbinical parables as we find them in the Talmud and other rabbinic literature, you're often struck by one thing. Some of them are very, very, very similar to Jesus' own parables. And there are, of course, three possibilities in there. There's a possibility that these parables were already floating around in rabbinic circles and Jesus used some of them. There's a possibility that many of the Pharisees were so struck by Jesus' parables that they adopted them and used them on their own. Or there's a third possibility that certain of these ideas come out of the Old Testament and parables with some of these structures were already in common use. So that neither does Jesus depend upon the Talmud, nor does the Talmud depend upon Jesus, but they both depend upon the way parables were being used in the last century B.C. and the first century to A.D., based on Old Testament background. Let's look at two examples of stock symbolism used in rabbinic and New Testament parables, which have Old Testament background. Many, many of the rabbinical parables picture God as a king. Most of the time when you see a king in a parable, it's a reference to God. Not always, but most of the time. Look with me, if you will, at the parables I've selected. Now, I've selected the parables here, and that was one of the principles by which I selected parables. This doesn't give you the whole spectrum of rabbinical parables, but I selected out ones that show you these resemblances. Parable number one pictures God as a king by the comparison that if a person who cleans statues of the king receives honor from the king and income from the king and things of that sort, then we, if we take care of our bodies, which are images of God the king, we ought to receive honor from God for that. You see there in a rather, very much in the background even, the functioning of God as king. Parable 2. Why is God? Gamaliel was asked why God is angry with idolaters and not with idols. And Gamaliel answers, a king had a son who raised a dog whom he named after his royal father. And whenever he was about to swear, he said, by the life of so-and-so, by the life of my dog so-and-so, and names the king. Okay. So if your father is Artaxerxes and you don't like Artaxerxes, you name your dog Artaxerxes. And when something goes wrong, you say, by the life of Artaxerxes, my dog, or something like that. Naturally, well, when the king heard of this, against whom did his anger turn? Against the dog or against the son? So, the point there. Well, if you look through these other examples, you'll see again and again the picture of a king in a parable is rather regularly a picture of God. not always, but regularly. Likewise, it's true in the New Testament. You think through some of the parables. Matthew 18, for instance, verses 21 through 25. How often shall I forgive my brother? There was a king who had someone owed him a huge debt, 10,000 talents, and he forgives his fellow. And when the fellow walks out of the palace breathing relief, he comes across somebody owes him 100 denarii or something, grabs him by the throat and starts to shake him. And the king, of course, gets very angry about that. And the whole picture is God has forgiven us a huge debt. We ought to forgive those who cannot do anything to us that would be equivalent to what the debt we owe God. over in Matthew 22, verses 1 through 14, the great supper that the king provides. A king had a son and was giving a wedding supper for him. He invited guests. The guests don't want to come. In fact, they begin to kill his servants, etc. You see a picture of a rebellion. Some city or two is in rebellion against this king. And whether they care about wedding feasts or not, most people like wedding feasts, particularly Eastern ones, where you have 5 or 6 or 7 days of banqueting and entertainment and everything, but they don't like the king. They don't like the king's son. So they show their rebellion by refusing the invitation. The king sends an army to destroy that city and goes out and gets other people to come in for the banquet. A picture of the relation of Israel to rejecting God's son and God's response to that. over in Luke 19, verses 11 through 27, we see another example. A certain nobleman went to a distant country to receive a kingdom and to return. We have a picture of something very common in Roman society, where a fellow, a native of some country, a noble native of that country, would be asked to come to Rome to be made king of that country and then sent back to rule a place. And the picture here is of Jesus going to heaven, a native of Israel going to heaven and to come back with the authority to rule. And so that's picked up. And here, obviously, then, who's he go away to? He goes away to some emperor, and he himself receives kingship and comes back. So, in fact, you have a way of setting up a double kingship here, the kingship of the son as well as the kingship of the emperor, which is just implied, but you receive the kingship from someone. So, now, what we have to give a little caution here. Not all parables with kings in them necessarily is the king God. And back in Luke 14, verses 31 through 33, we have, in fact, a counterexample. What king, when he sets out to meet another king in battle, will not first sit down and take counsel, see whether he's strong enough with 10,000 to meet the other guy, comes with 20,000? That's just referring to what kings do. You're fighting a war. You want to make sure you've got enough forces to have a chance of either winning the battle or causing a standoff. If you're sure you're going to be defeated, you might as well try and make terms of some sort. So there, obviously, the king doesn't represent God. There's two kings in the parable. It's just what kings ought to do. And the lesson drawn from it is you ought to make sure that if you're going to stand before God in judgment, that you're going to be able to stand and not to fall, that you can do something about that sort of thing. So at least one of the kings, obviously, is not God. Well, another example of a stock symbolism that occurs in both rabbinic parables and in New Testament parables is the picture of the age to come as a banquet. Picture of the age to come as a banquet. This shows up in a number of the rabbinic parables. The clearest one is 4. Rabbi Jacob said, "This world is like a vestibule before the world to come. Prepare yourself in the vestibule so that you may enter the banqueting hall." The world we're in is like the entrance hall to the banquet hall, which is the age to come. Just as when you get to the banquet hall, you may not have been wearing your fine clothes all the way. You might have come 50 miles and you have them all wrinkled up and everything. You put them on in the vestibule before you go in. We would think perhaps of straightening our tie or something of that variety. But here we're looking at their culture. So here, this world is a time to prepare yourself for the age to come. Parable 3 here is also a parable of the sort, the age to come as a banquet. And so likewise is parable 23. I won't go into those, but you might have a look at those as well. In the New Testament, Matthew 22, verses 1 through 14 has the same thing. The king sends forth people to come to a wedding feast. That wedding feast is obviously something like the millennium or the eternal state or something of that variety. And you can't get into it without the right kind of robe, and you can't get into it if you're in rebellion against the king. And it helps you to interpret that, to see that that was a rather common stock phrase. Likewise, Luke chapter 12, 37 is probably a hint of this variety, is a thing of this variety. Blessed are those slaves whom the master shall find on the alert when he comes. Truly I say to you, he will gird himself to serve and have them recline at table and will come and wait on them. A picture of the Lord's return. Something very different happens to the slaves. Instead of being slaves, they're hosts, they're guests at the banquet provided by the master. More clearly, we would see Luke 14, 15 to 24 as falling in this category. When one of those who were reclining at table with him heard this, he said, "Blessed is everyone who shall eat bread in the kingdom of God." And Jesus' response is, a certain man was giving a big dinner and invited many. The fellow himself understands eating bread in the kingdom of God, some idea of a banquet relating to the kingdom of God. Jesus takes that up and goes into that with a parable. One of the major points of his parable is the people who talk a good case of wanting to go to heaven often are the very ones who turn down the conditions that are involved. And they turn down the invitation that God provides. They've got better things to do with their time than to be concerned about the kingdom of heaven. If you look through the parable there. There are many more such stock symbols. I'll let you work your way through this four pages of parables and see if you can find some more lurking there from your own knowledge of New Testament parables and some features showing up in these. There's a very striking one in here that's like the parable of the workers in the vineyard who work all day, and some of them work all day, some of them work a few hours, etc., and they all receive the same amount. It's interesting, a very different lesson in here, but it'd be interesting to look at that. And I think it shows us that the day's work was understood as a parallel for our lifetime, and being paid at the end of the day, as day laborers regularly were, would be something like the Last Judgment. Okay, we've got to move rather quickly now. I did not make it one point in that. Parables regularly employ stock symbolism from the Old Testament. There are Old Testament passages that speak of God as king, several of them. The most striking, I think, is in Malachi 1:14. Look that up sometime, where the Israelites are rather sloppy in the kind of animals they're bringing to sacrifice to God. God says, give some of those animals as presents to your governor and see how he reacts to it. And then he says in Malachi 1:14, am I not a great king? You know, if your attitude towards me is would be something that a governor or a king would, it wouldn't impress him at all. Why do you think you can impress me with that kind of sloppy service? The age to come as a banquet, we do have one passage in the Old Testament I can think of. There may be others. In Isaiah 25:6, the Lord of hosts will prepare a lavish banquet for all peoples on this mountain. A banquet of aged wine, choice pieces with marrow of refined aged wine. And on this mountain he will swallow up the covering which is over all the peoples, even the veil which is stretched over all nations. He will swallow up death for all time. And the Lord will wipe away tears from all faces, and he will remove the reproach of his people from all the earth. For the Lord has spoken. Picture here of a banquet somehow associated with the end of death, the end of sorrow, etc. And it's going to be on this mountain, says God. I suspect this would indicate that the prophet is standing on probably what we would call in ancient times Mount Zion, the site of the temple, that sort of thing, though I don't know that for a fact. Would fit in other biblical passages. Well, two other principles that we want to work on here. Number four. I believe there's warrant to say, from what we know about both rabbinic teachers and Jesus, that all details of a parable are significant. All details of a parable are significant, but some are intended only to give realism and vividness to the story, and others are intended to be interpreted for the heavenly meaning or whatever it has. All details of a parable are significant, but some are intended only to give realism, vividness, that sort of thing, and other features, other details are intended to be features that should show up in the interpretation. Why do I say all details of a parable are significant? Well, first of all, we're talking about a society that was an oral society, and a society that delighted in short, pithy sayings, and in trying to compress information into the smallest possible space. The Talmudic material, particularly the Mishnah, the oldest part, is almost incomprehensible to a person who has not studied and studied and studied in the area, because they compress it and compress it and compress it. The reason, they had to memorize it all. And there's only so much can stick in your head. I don't know how much that is. It's a lot more than I've got. But there's only so much can stick in your head. And so they get it down to structures that are memorable. You can see that very much in Jesus' teaching. He uses a lot of parallelism. He uses paradoxes. He uses vivid things to help you remember things and keeps it short. For instance, the Sermon on the Mount, as we have it in the Gospels at least, only takes about 20, 25 minutes to read. Remember a pastor I had at one time who once a year would give the Sermon on the Mount as his sermon, would recite it from memory. Apparently his disciples too memorized his teaching and were able to give it back to the followers. That's certainly the case with the rabbis. That's certainly the case with the students of the Greek philosophers. And under those circumstances, you don't waste words. You think out carefully what you're going to say, and you get your words all together. We're very sloppy in wasting words because we can print books, huge books, easily. So there's a lot of things that could be said in 20 pages that in order to sell, they say them in 175 pages because that's a standard book length. And you can sell that for $3.95, whereas something 25 pages long, you only sell for 50 cents. So that's regularly done. The point, however, is not necessarily that every detail in the thing is to be transferred over into the realm of the significance of the parable. Some of it may be just to make it very clear in your mind what's going on. And then only perhaps in some cases 1 point, in some cases 2 points, in some cases 10 points will transfer over into the meaning. Now, naturally, these are arguable matters, but I think most people will agree on that sort of a matter. The problem is deciding which is which, okay, and that's not going to be easy. So I might suggest that with the parable of the woman and the meal, that the three measures of meal, you can find from other Old Testament backgrounds, is a rather standard amount of meal that a woman would make up. And the choice of a woman, that's the one who usually did the baking in the home. Of course, professional bakers might be men, but women. And putting leaven in the meal, of course, would be put in the meal. Some of those may have some significance because Jesus could have talked about potters putting a glaze on pottery or something. You know, he didn't talk about that. He talked about a woman putting meal and putting leaven in meal, but not necessarily all of those features intended to have a conveyance over into the heavenly meaning. And some of those just for you to see immediately what the person is doing and strike your mind, and then you can fill in a lot of other details of the story because that's the way people regularly operate. So intended to give realism and vividness. But others are intended to give interpretation, and you have to figure out what those are. From Jesus' own interpretation of the parable of the sower, and the parable of the tares, and the parable of the dragnet, we can see that many details have significance in parables, and yet we don't always know how far to push in these various directions. Well, the fifth principle then, the last principle, is an attempt to try and tell how you go about finding what principles may be significant. Number 5, to interpret a parable, that is to separate the vividness detail from the significance detail, and then to figure out what the significance detail, what its significance is, there are certain things you need to consider. You need to consider the context. Why did Jesus say it? What was going on? What was he responding to? What was the problem at hand when he says this? That's obviously going to be helpful in figuring out what's going on in the parable itself. You need to consider background, Old Testament background. As we pointed out in number 3, there's a lot of stock symbolism used in various things. And the way stock symbolism shows up in New Testament rabbinic parables are often things that are merely metaphors or similes in the Old Testament now are worked together into a story. And yet because you have this Old Testament background and the significance of this metaphor or simile, that begins to give you hints on what the parable itself is about. And so you need to, if you have leaven, or if you have birds, or if you have a tree growing up so it's taller and the birds in the nest come in and settle in its branches, you may find it'd be helpful to look for Old Testament parallels to those things, and they'll help you understand some of what is going on. Thirdly, you need to consider parallels. The most important parallels to consider, obviously, are other New Testament parallels that may be helpful in interpreting the parable of the parable of the prodigal son by looking at the parable of lost sheep and lost coin, which are in its context and have some parallel ideas. It might be helpful in understanding the parable of the marriage feast for the king's son by looking at a similar parable in Luke regarding a fellow inviting someone to a dinner. It's a simple parable and will help you to understand some of the features. And then you ask, why are the features in this other one different from that? And what is their significance? Why were they made different? Are they just different because now we're talking about a king? Why did Jesus bother to talk about a king as opposed to someone else? What's these extra things about the garment? And by the way, the wedding garment there, that might be interesting then to take a study of symbolic use of garment in the Old Testament. You'll find out that you don't come down with one meaning, because a garment is used symbolically for a number of things, but you will find some possibilities then to think through and see which ones seem to make the best sense for understanding what's going on in the parable. Rabbinic parables can also be very helpful, parallel parables from rabbinic background. They're not inspired, but they are information about historic background in the same period. They are information about types of connections which people at that time made between certain symbols and certain interpretations. And so if you can dig out some of those, they would be helpful. Unfortunately, it's not easy to dig out rabbinic parables. This mass of that I've got here is probably about 1/10 to 1/50 of the rabbinic parables that exist. I don't know how you go about finding them exactly. You can look in articles on parables in Jewish encyclopedias, and they give you a bunch. I've gotten some of those on here. The best source I found, in fact, was a little work called Every Man's Talmud. It's in this British cheap edition. It's called Every Man Library. And this one written by a Jewish fellow named Cohen. And what he had done better than anybody else is there was a nice index in the back, and one of the headings under index was parables, and it had about 25 or 30 entries. So I just looked up all of those, and suddenly there are parables staring at you. The Cencino Talmud, 35 volumes, only has a few things listed under parables, though it's filled with parables. It was just so many of them they didn't bother to make a listing under that heading. So short of just sitting down and reading it, they're hard to find. Another place that might be helpful would be Strack-Billerbeck's Kommentar zum Neuen Testament aus Talmud und Midrash, but it's in German. And if you can't read German, you're up a creek, so to speak. So it's never been translated into English. Recently, there has been a work by Robert Lightfoot written in the 1600s, translated into English, which is also a commentary on the New Testament based on the Talmudic materials. I haven't gotten a copy. It's very expensive. But if you're interested in that sort of thing and you've got money to spend, you might look into that. I think it's Robert Lightfoot, and the title is something like a commentary on the New Testament from the rabbinic literature, from the Talmudic literature, or something of that sort. Well, we've got to stop now. I was going to try and look at a test case or two, but my voice is about shot, and we have at least covered the general sort of idea here. These principles up here have some merit, but you have to watch them. These principles down here also have some merit, and you have to watch them. I think they've got more merit, and you don't have to watch them as closely. But having given all these principles, you still can't just kind of pour the principles in one side, the Bible in the other, turn the crank, and the answers come out. Interpreting parables is not easy business. There's a lot of disagreement. But obviously, if you take the liberal approach of throwing out the context and then ignoring the rabbinic fact that there are complicated parables with allegorical meanings and saying Jesus couldn't have done it that way, you're going to have a tough time ever finding out what the parable means. So you need to pay attention to these things.
Biblical Theological Seminary is happy to have brought you this study in God's Word. We minister to people through our graduate and postgraduate degree programs, our community evening school, our cassette ministry, special seminars, and a free publication, Biblical Bulletin, containing interesting articles by biblical faculty members. For a free cassette catalog or more information about the seminary, please write to Biblical Theological Seminary, 200 North Main Street, Hatfield, Pennsylvania, zip code 19440.